Okay, good afternoon and welcome to this panel, Identity in Fiction. My name is Lynn Benson and I'm a board member of the Boston chapter of the Women's National Book Association. Just a quick summary of who we are. The Women's National Book Association was begun in 1917 by a group of booksellers who, because they were women, had been denied entry into the National Booksellers Association. The WNBA expanded into 10 chapters nationwide and now includes both women and men involved in all aspects of the book world. Publishers, editors, writers, librarians, book reviewers, and readers. One aspect of our mission is National Reading Group Month. Every October, all 10 chapters of the WNBA celebrate those readers who, by joining or initiating book clubs, remain indispensable to the continued life of books. We have a list of great group reads, and accompanying booklets are free, so please take one on your way out if there are any left. Also, we are raffling off a Kobo e-reader, so please make sure to put your name and email in the hat. This year's main sponsor of National Reading Group Month is Atria Books. Other sponsors include Crown Publishing, Extra Libris, HarperCollins, Other Press, and Sourcebooks. Our chapter's contribution to NRGM is today's panel, Identity in Fiction, which centers on three books we think are excellent fodder for book clubs, great reads that explore various aspects of personal and public identity. Moderating this session, we're so fortunate to have Anne Kingman, who by day is a celebrated sales representative for Random House, and who for years has hosted the wildly popular podcast, Books on the Nightstand. She's going to take it from here and enjoy the program. And thank you for coming.
Thank you, Lynn. Can everybody hear me? Okay, we have to apologize from the stage because the lights, we can't see anything beyond maybe the fourth row. So for that reason, if we're making faces, it's not at you, I promise. Thank you all for coming and finding your way through the maze to this room. I am thrilled to be asked to moderate this panel. Three authors who I deeply admire and books that grabbed me from the very beginning. And I think the concept of identity in fiction is one that's really interesting to explore. So first I'm going to introduce our authors, and then they're each going to talk and or read from their books, each about 10 minutes. Then we'll have a 15-minute or so discussion about the concept of identity in fiction, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. And in case I forgot to tell you, we have two mics set here in the aisles because this panel is being recorded via audio. So when we do the Q&A, if you would just line up at the mics, we'll take questions from there so that everybody can hear. So to my right, I'd like to introduce Miriam Carmel. I should have checked your name, I'm sorry. Carmel?
That's good.
Miriam has worked professionally as a newspaper reporter and magazine editor, and most recently as a freelance writer specializing in medicine and health. Her journalism has appeared in AARP magazine and for many years in Minnesota Women's Press. Her fiction has won numerous regional prizes, and her stories have been published in Bellevue Literary Review, Minnesota Monthly, and anthologized in Milkweed's Fiction on a Stick. Miriam lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Being Esther is her first novel. Next to Miriam is Jessica Keener. Jessica's been listed in the Pushcart Prize under Outstanding Writers, and her fiction has appeared in many publications, most recently Night Train and Wilderness House Literary Review. A recipient of the Massachusetts Cultural Council's Artist Grant Program and second prize in fiction from Red Book Magazine, her feature articles have appeared in the Boston Globe, Design New England, O, the Oprah Magazine, and other national publications. Jessica's first novel, Night Swim, was published to critical acclaim, and her newest book is Women in Bed, a collection of 9 short stories. And to Jessica's right, Amity Gage. Amity's the author of 3 novels, Oh My Darling, The Folded World, and most recently, Schroeder, which was published in 2013. Her essays, articles, and stories have appeared in various publications, including the Yale Review, Los Angeles Times, O Magazine, the Literary Review, and in a 2009 collection of essays, Feed Me. Amity is the recipient of a Fulbright Fellowship, a McDowell Colony Fellowship, and is currently the visiting writer at Amherst College. She lives in Amherst, Massachusetts with her family. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So if you would all, we're going to start kind of go this way, maybe introduce your book to the audience, read a little bit if you like, and just kind of set it up so that when we have our discussion about identity and fiction, everybody pretty much has a reference point. So you want to start with you, Miriam?
Yes. It's nice to see everyone on this sunny day inside listening to books. The title of my book is Being Esther, and here we are talking about being and identity, so that feels fitting that I'm on this panel. Esther Lustig is an 85-year-old widow who lives in Chicago in an apartment on her own. She has a rather annoying but well-meaning daughter, Steely, who's trying to move her to assisted living. Esther does not want to move. And the story moves in and out of time with Esther reflecting on her past and at the same time living in her life in the present, trying to maintain her dignity and her independence as both time and her body betray her. I thought I'd read a passage from the book that gets at the whole question of what is someone's identity? Like, who are you? If it's that question, and Esther is asking this of herself. There's references to a woman named Miss Smaller, who is someone who's in Esther's apartment building who died. Milo is the building superintendent, and Lorraine, a longtime friend and neighbor of Esther. Esther is at the kitchen table, nursing a mug of tea and going through the newspaper while waiting for Lorraine to call. Always, she starts with the obituaries, then works her way through the rest of the bad news: war, famine, the endless terror of the human condition. She ends on a lighter note with Ann Landers and the Funnies. On the really bad news days, she'll turn to the sports, especially when the Cubs are playing. Then she can commiserate with Milo, an avid fan, over something other than the weather. She didn't always start with the obituaries and can even recall a time when she scanned them with a kind of detachment, as if the subject at hand did not apply to her. Not that she ever assumed she would be the one to get a free pass. Yet reading the notices, as she once did, Marty, seated across from her at the kitchen table, the sugar bowl and vitamins on a doily between them, her coffee mug set squarely on a blue quilted placemat, death was something remote, something that happened to other people. Then Marty died. Esther recalls the week after his funeral when she opened the morning paper and in her grief had mistaken it for that day's edition. As was her habit, she turned first to the obituaries. Her trained eye scanned the names, barely reading them, for in a city as large as Chicago, Esther could go weeks without knowing any of the deceased. Most days, her eyes fixed only on the number beside the name, whereupon a quick actuarial accounting, she understood that she had, by almost any measure, already beaten the odds. But that morning after Marty's funeral, her eye tripped and stumbled on a bold block of type. Then came the shock of recognition. Lustig, Martin. LustigMartin. She decoded the letters, stringing them together like a child learning to read. Then her name jumped out and her mouth went dry. What was she doing there, her name nestled among the dead? It felt like a sneak preview, a coming attraction for the day when she would boldly appear and the names of her children, grandchildren, the husband who had predeceased her would traipse faintly behind. Perhaps someone would think to add a personal touch, though nobody had thought of doing that for Marty. The woman whose name appeared below Marty's was remembered for the stuffed mushrooms and the laughter she brought to family gatherings. Her name was Lenore. Esther wondered about Lenore's laugh. Esther's friend Helen, a smoker, laughed until the phlegm rattled in her chest. Her mother had snorted when she laughed. Her son doesn't know how to laugh. Whenever Esther says something funny, Barry smiles, and even then, only one side of his mouth turns up. Even his smile is crooked. She imagined Lenore's laughter sounded like wind chimes in a gentle breeze. Sharing the page with Lenore and Marty was a man who had organized family reunions every July for 23 years, and there was a woman who'd worn fanciful hats. Esther's hats were on hooks in the front hall closet, but were any of them fanciful? Had she ever organized a reunion? For a few years, when her children were younger, she sang in the temple choir. She couldn't remember why she ever quit. Ordinary. Perhaps that's how they describe Esther, which was how Miss Smaller in 3G had been remembered in her obituary. Poor Miss Smaller. If a body didn't decompose, give off a stench worse than rotten potatoes, how long until anyone would have missed her? Milo discovered her body, a heart attack. She was young for that, mid-50s, but a heart attack all the same. For days, nobody claimed her body. Finally, a phone number on a slip of paper led to a niece, the one who posted the obituary. Miss Smaller was an ordinary woman, it said. After Miss Smaller's death, Lorraine had asked Esther, "What would you say about me?" They were sitting in the courtyard beside the statue of St. Francis. "Say?" Esther looked quizzically at her friend. "You know, after I'm gone." Esther glared at her friend. "What kind of question is that?" She and Lorraine had known each other since high school. What was there to say? Since retiring, Lorraine had been studying Italian and serving meals to the homeless. She'd roped Esther into a writing class at the community center. She baked elaborate birthday cakes for her nieces and hazelnut torts for special occasions. "Well," Esther hesitated, I would say that you don't share your recipes. Lorraine's face collapsed. "This isn't the time for jokes, Esther." Later, Esther phoned her friend and apologized. "The truth is, you do so much, Lorraine, that I didn't know where to begin. But should anyone ask, I'd have to say she made the most spectacular hazelnut torts." Now, waiting for her friend to call, Esther looks up from the obituaries and sees, as if for the first time, the vitamins, the sugar bowl, the ruffled edging on the blue quilted placemat. Such homely objects. Yet each has a sense of purpose. The longer she stares at them, the more they mock her with their specificity. They know what they're about. They aren't sitting around conjuring the few taglines that might explain the meaning of their existence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica.
Hey, so you can hear me all right? So my newest book is called Women in Bed. It's a collection of 9 stories, and they are thematically linked. 5 of the 9 stories feature the same woman, and in terms of identity, Women in Bed, it's a bit, obviously, it's a provocative title. It's interesting to see how people identify with that, the name of that title, and what the associations people bring to it. I saw the bed as a symbol of intimacy and love relationships also. But I'm going to read from the first story, which again features the same protagonist 4 other times along the way. And I purposely don't name her in this first story, which again, I guess, relates to the whole sense of identity. The first story is called Secrets, and basically there are 2 women, and the protagonist is sort of attracted to this other woman who is nudging the protagonist to kind of bring out what's been submerged emotionally for her. So I'll read for about 5 minutes.
Sure.
Secrets. Every day when I walk up to her with my pencil and a pad, she orders the same thing, chef salad with Russian dressing and coffee. That's all we've said to each other. I nod, go get the stuff, and bring it back to her. She smiles and our eyes meet. Her eyes are gray speckled, smooth stones lying next to the sea. Her skin is pale and her hair curls where it is not held back with barrettes. It reminds me of grass and wooden fences. So far, she has never once brought a friend, like most people, just a book for writing in. I've noticed, too, that she comes in at the same time. I begin to look forward to it. In this work, I have time to notice these things. My job is monotonous, and her visits are a relief. As soon as she sits down, the air around her table forms a breathable shell shaped by her thoughts. She orders a salad, and when I bring it to her, she eats quickly, bite after bite. But she's not rushed. She always stays for an hour. When I pour her first cup of coffee, she slows down. She asks for a refill after carelessly lipping the cold ceramic rim, and sometimes she asks for a third and fourth cup while she writes. And I'm certain she watches me. If I look over to see how she's doing, she's there looking back, so I smile. She appreciates this and returns to her book. I resume placing orders, cleaning tables, wiping the countertop with a damp rag. It's summer now. Most of the women who come into the restaurant wear open V-neck blouses. The women who wear tight blazers are the executive types. They bring their briefcases to work. Then there are the men with the yellow pants, loafers, and pink roll-up sleeve shirts. Not my taste particularly. My friend wears dungaree jumpsuits without sleeves. Not my taste either, but her manners are. I like the way she sits at the table, unconcerned that she is eating alone. I like the sure-footedness of her voice. She speaks directly. Her eyes focus on me as if she knows who I am. Few people do. Most people just comment on my hair. It's saffron gold and twists along the small of my back below my waist. I braid it for work. Even so, it gets in my way when I try to yank overstuffed bags of trash out of the barrels that contain them. She is about the same height, same weight as me, but my arms are softer and her walk has more purpose. Anyway, I have this urge to follow her when she walks out the door each day and starts down the street. I consider it when I am scraping dirty plates or counting dimes and cents at the register. Today, she nods her head at me in the middle of her salad. "Why are you working here?" she asks. "Paying rent." "You're miserable," she says. "I've seen you biting your lip. Your left hand is trembling." "I'm recovering from suicidal tendencies," I answer, testing her response. She smiles back in a way that is very pleased and approving, so I leave again and get on with my chores. I remain cryptic. I have never opened easily to people. At the end of her lunch hour, I return with her check, and again she smiles. I don't even look up to watch her walk out because I know she'll be back. The following day, I'm ready with her meal when she comes through the door. "Why don't you meet me tomorrow after work?" she says. "We'll talk." I peer inside her, pull back, and scan the rest of her face. "Fine," I say. "I'll wait for you here." I go over to a booth and take orders from three good-looking men. They all have dark eyes, plump mouths. "Who keeps you busy after work?" one of them asks. "Three men," I joke, "more than I can keep track of." Their eyes widen and their Adam's apples bounce up and down as they all laugh. At 4:30, I go into the bathroom, unbutton my uniform, and slip on my dress. It's red. My skin is tanned. I brush out my hair with long, exacting strokes. Outside, the women are looking at me. The men are honking. They should. I feel my eyes opening to the world. Now everyone wants to jump in. I might have known she wouldn't show. I waited 40 minutes at work, drank two cups of coffee, and left. "I wasn't feeling well," she says the next day. "Don't be hurt." I nod. I'm furious. "I promise I'll come by tonight. You have a lovely face." Only when I pick up her empty wooden bowl do I glance out the window and see her, an image through glass, moving away. She disappears where the picture window ends, so I stare back into the bowl. There is one flat piece of onion skin at the bottom. It is what I know of her. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. That's
so short.
So good. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the introduction. I guess the question that the author gets most frequently is also, for me, the hardest to answer, which is, what's your book about? which is, I've asked authors other times, many times. There's so many different ways to answer that question. I think for me, with my novel Schroeder, it is about identity. It's also about the intensity of parental love, how wonderful it is to get it right and how horrible it is to get it wrong. But when people ask, what's the book about, you know, they don't necessarily mean those themes. They want to know, you know, what happens and who are the central characters. I have a friend, by the way, who when people ask him what his book's about, to sort of shrug off the question, he says, despair. I want to try that sometime when I don't feel like answering. But the book is, what's the book about on the level of character and event? It's about a man who calls himself Eric Kennedy. He is writing a letter to his estranged wife, explaining where he has been with their daughter for the past week. And he sort of, during a parental visit, they're separated, they're divorced. He during a sanctioned parental visit, he takes their six-year-old daughter, Meadow, and goes on the road with her throughout New England. And Meadow is at first very excited, and then as things go on, less excited, especially when there's like a police chase and stuff. But what this letter is about is not just those events. It's also an apology and an explanation of who Eric really is, and he is Schroeder, the name of the book. He is an East German immigrant, and he has obscured this information from his wife until now, until this confession. And you find out pretty early on in the book that he's writing from jail, so that doesn't really spoil it. Those of you from the city might hear familiar elements of this plot, the Clark Rockefeller story, but I will fully admit that I stole some things from that story. But it's not a novelization of that story at all, so I'm happy to talk about that more. I'll read from the beginning. So it literally is addressed to Laura in the second person. One more thing. When I read it these days, I feel so inadequate because I heard the audiobook of this, and it's a man reading, and he does a brilliant job. And I'm like, oh, that's Eric. That's when I hear my voice, yeah, I'm a woman. It's not. Imagine I'm a man. Imagine my voice is being filtered, you know, morphed into a man's voice. What follows is a record of where Meadow and I have been since our disappearance. My lawyer says I should tell the whole story, where we went, what we did, who we met, etc. As you know, Laura, I'm not a reticent person. I'm talkative. You could even say chatty for a man. But I haven't spoken a word for days. It's a vow I've taken. My mouth tastes old and damp, like a cave. It turns out I'm not very good at being silent. There are castles of things I want to tell you, which might explain the enthusiasm of this document, despite what you could call its sad story. My lawyer also says that this document could someday help me in court. So it's hard not to think of this as a sort of plea, not just for your mercy, but also for that of a theoretical jury should we go to trial. And in case the word jury sounds exciting to you, it did to me for a second. I've since learned that a jury gets all kinds of things wrong, cleaving as it does to initial impressions, and in the end rarely offers the ringing exonerations or punishments that we deserve. It's hard not to think about them anyway, my potential listeners, lawyers, juries, fairy tale mobs, historians, but most of all you, my whip, my nation, my wife. Dear Laura, if it were just the two of us again, sitting together at the kitchen table late at night, I would probably just call this document an apology. Once upon a time, in 1984, I created another fateful document. On the surface, it was an application to a boys' camp on Ossipee Lake in New Hampshire. I was 14 and had been living in the United States for only 5 years. During those 5 years, my father and I had occupied the same top-floor apartment of a tenement in Dorchester, Mass., which, if you have never been there, is a crowded, multiracial neighborhood in Boston's southern hinterlands. Even though I had quieted my accent and cloaked myself in a Bruins hockey shirt and tried to appear as tough and sulky as my Irish-American counterparts who formed Dorchester's racial minority, I was still mentally fresh off the boat and was still discovering, on a daily basis, the phenomena of my new homeland. I remember the electronic swallowing sound of a quarter by the slot of my first video game machine, as well as the sight of a vibrating electronic toothbrush, and how, one day, while I was waiting for the bus, a boy not much older than me drove up to the curb in a Corvette convertible and hopped out without use of the door. I remember seeing many sights like this and more because the feelings they brought up were confusing. At first, I'd feel a pop of childish wonder, But this wonder was followed by the urge to stuff it back, because if I were a real American, I would not have been in the least impressed with any of it. Self-consciousness was my escort, a certain doubleness of mind that I relied upon to keep myself from asking stupid questions, such as when Dad and I drove across the border of Rhode Island one day on an errand, and I resisted asking why there was no checkpoint between state lines, for I had, if you can believe it, brought my German passport with me. I first saw the brochure for Camp Ossipee in my pediatrician's office. I studied it every time I was sick until I slipped it in my jacket and took it home. I stared at this brochure for weeks, in bed, in the bath, hanging from my pull-up bar, until its pages started to stick together. The American boys in the photographs hung suspended in the air between cliffside and lake water. They walked in threes, portaging canoes. I started to envision myself swimming with them. I imagined myself crawling through the wheat or whatever, learning to track and to mushroom. I would be the go-to man, the boy out in front, not so much the hero, but an outrider. I was particularly interested in the Ossipean rite of passage available only to the oldest boys in their final year, a solo overnight camping trip on a remote island in the middle of the lake. And here is where my future self was really born to me, in this image, myself, Eric Schroeder, man alive, stoking a fire in the night, solo, self-sufficient, freed from the restrictions of society. I would fall asleep as one boy and wake up the next day a totally different one. All I had to do to apply to the camp was to fill out a form and write a personal statement. What sort of statement were they looking for, I wondered. What sort of boy? I sat at my father's card table, gazing out the window at the corner of Sagamore and Savin Hill Ave, where two classmates of mine were fighting over a broken hockey stick. I slipped a piece of paper into my father's typewriter. I began to write. Mine was a tale that, by certain lights, was the truest thing I had ever written. It involved the burdens of history, an early loss of the mother, a baseless sense of personal responsibility, and a dauntless hope for the future. Of course, by other lights, the lights that everyone else uses, including courts of law, my story was pure canard, a fraudulent, distorted, spurious, crooked, desperate fiction, which, when I met you, I lay bound at your feet. But this was 1984. I hadn't met you yet. I wasn't lying to you. I was just a child sitting at my father's typewriter, my legs trussed to the knee in white athletic socks, my hair still rabbit blonde, not dark at the roots like it is now. I addressed the envelope. I stole a stamp. When it came time to sign the bottom of that crowded page, it was with some flair that I first signed the name by which you came to know me. The surname wasn't hard to choose. I wanted a hero's name. And there was only one man I'd ever heard called a hero in Dorchester, a local boy, a persecuted Irishman, a demigod. He was also a man who'd spoken to cheering throngs of depressed West Berliners circa 1963, leaving them with a shimmering feeling of self-regard that lasted long beyond his assassination. His hero status still in place when my father and I finally got there much later. In fact, you might say John F. Kennedy is the reason we showed up in this country at all. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. I guess I should be talking myself.
So the thing that struck me as the most interesting when we were talking about the panel and the concept of identity in fiction is that all of you have books that strongly deal with identity, but you all handle it in very different ways. Hmm. So Amity, your character deliberately chooses to take on a new identity and leave his old one behind. Mm-hmm. And Miriam, your character Esther has sort of lost her identity. She suddenly doesn't know who she is now that she's grown older and her life has changed. And then Jessica, in the story that you read, I don't think your character necessarily even knows who she is at that point. And over the course of the book, she evolves. You described it as a process of being and becoming, which is sort of how we got the title for this panel. And I'd love to know kind of how, Identity. Did you all set out to write a story about identity and then choose to handle it, or did the story evolve after the characters? If you could each talk about that a little bit, maybe starting with you, Amity, and kind of going down this way.
Sure, yes. It's always been an interest to me. I do think that my several other books deal with identity, too. I remember as a child, actually, having a real awareness of the fact that I was creating who I wanted to be. I feel bad for myself thinking of this now, but if I act this way, people like it. If I act this way, they don't like it. I want to be liked, so I'm going to act this way. I mean, the sense that the identity gets constructed was something I actually was aware of even as a kid. So I took with Eric, of course, it's a very literal and slightly exaggerated notion of creating an identity. In his case, he creates a separate identity, I think, because who he really is just too painful. He doesn't want to be who he really is, so he'd rather be a liar than who he really is. This all breaks down, of course. So I think something that's interesting to me when I think about identity is there an essential self that doesn't change and that is not dependent upon some of behaviors and names or not, or are we all completely constructed? And so I guess I take him through these through that question. In a lot of ways, that's what the book is trying to figure that out. And if I answer the question, I'm not sure, but I do know that in the process of trying to tell that story, I think I felt that, no, he did have an essential self that he could not finally get away from. You can't completely construct everything else. There's something that real and inborn that comes with you. That's what I came up with.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating. Probably I have an urge coming almost all to the opposite of what you're talking about, where it seems that I always go back to characters who are struggling to allow that identity that is there emerge, pushing, and it's an emotional process and battle to push away often what feels overwhelming for the character emotionally, whether it's, you know, family issues, love issues, relationship issues, and figuring out, you know, as a character, who am I within the context of another person, and can I maintain who I am within the context of that other person, or will I be swayed or pushed or changed or submerged because of that other person? So it seems that I'm always going back to the struggle to have the character sort of persist and insist on becoming who she is. Not that it's lost, but often the sense of being below the surface. Mm-hmm. So, and getting rid of those external constructs that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, right. I mean, if you deal with identity just as yourself, it's one person, it's one issue. But as soon as you have identity in relation to someone else, it's totally different.
Right. You know, the complexity quadruples, basically.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So.
And then when you lose that person who's close to you, it becomes something different.
Yeah. Right. I mean, then you know, in terms of grief or just, you know, the despair, what's lost? How do you regain who you are if you've seen yourself in relation to another person? So.
And I think that relates to Esther very much, Miriam.
I didn't set out to write a book in which I was exploring the issue of identity, and yet somewhere midway through the process, possibly, I was writing, well, this is what it's like to be Esther. This is about being Esther, and there was the title. Still, it's, I think the passage I read is the one where she gets closest to really struggling with that question of who she is, but so much of the book revolves around her memories and her reliving her past, and I think in doing so, she's telling herself the story of her life, and in the process, then, she's trying to construct an answer. Like, I've lived all these years, probably more than, many people. She beat the odds, as she thought, and still, who am I? And at one point, I was asked, well, if you did have to construct a kind of tagline for Esther, you know, she made, you know, she had beautiful laughter and, you know, this one wore fanciful hats, what would it be? And I actually really struggled with that, and I'd already written this book and I felt like I knew her inside out, and yet it was hard to come up with actually who she is. And I decided that some sounded too negative, some sounded not, well, she enjoyed reading. Well, that just didn't sound, you know, that's not an identity or a tagline. It didn't feel sufficient for who she was. And then I just all of a sudden realized, as I'm kind of going through all the options, that what really happened was that she put others first, and that would be her tagline. And she really is representative, I think, of a woman of a particular generation who did that, put others first. And that is who I think Esther is.
I'm fascinated by the concept of names, and they play a role in all of your books as well. It's almost like someone came up with this panel and then stuck you guys in. So Miriam, your book opens, the first line, the first sentence is, they named her Esther, and then goes on to talk about, I loved this passage, about how she always thought she was named after someone, and then it turned out that she wasn't, and how that even slanted her identity a little bit. And Jessica, I'd really like to talk about the fact that your character in the story that you read, Secrets, is unnamed, and you said deliberately so, but then goes on to have a name, and it slightly changes a little bit throughout the other stories that she is in. And then, of course, Eric, who changed not just his last name, but also the spelling of his first name. Mm-hmm. So do you think names are important? And you know, when you made those choices, was it just a name that you chose and then kind of fit the story around it? Or did you think of very deliberate reasons for those specific names for your characters? Why don't we start with Miriam?
Some characters I really think a lot about. The name just, I'll be using a name and it doesn't fit and it just doesn't feel right. And Esther's name, I started writing Esther as short stories. And so I wrote, the first story was about this woman named Esther Lustig. And I wrote another story and another one, and they became Esther stories. And I probably originally chose her name because, you know, there's names that go in cycles. And someone, Jen, just said, well, you know, everyone like my age is Jen. Well, I think in a certain generation, there were a lot of Esthers. And it was that the opening of the book, where I say they named her Esther, was really kind of a writing exercise that turned into something bigger. And I was just playing around with exploring how her thoughts about how she got her name, or trying to explain how she got her name. So that kind of came after I'd already named Esther.
Interesting.
Yeah, names matter a lot to me. And well, in these stories, I mean, in terms of the five that where she does have the same name, obviously. But I did select pretty ordinary in some ways name in common for recent error. Jen, Jennifer, Jenny. And I guess I did that on purpose. I didn't want it to be an exotic name because I, again, was part of the struggle with her identity. It was about the struggle of feeling ordinary or, you know, wanting to figure out what made her special, the sense of being special. And so somehow it felt important to me not to give her some sort of super exotic name in that regard. But sometimes I go through lists and, you know, I wear one name for the character for a while and then it just doesn't feel right. And so I do go through some gyrations over names, for sure.
Well, I had my seed story. I sort of, you know, part of the inspiration was kind of ripped from the headlines. And I knew this guy was going to name himself some sort of iconic last name. I went through many different things. Some silly ideas. Like he would be Edison or, you know, Ford. And then same with the German last name. I knew the title of the book. I wanted it to be his real name. And those were even harder. I had many different choices and German names. And some of them are going to be hard for American audience to pronounce. So things like, you know, well, Bueller's okay. I was like, oh, you know, Werfel or something like that. It needed to be a German name that an American audience could pronounce. So that's sort of how I came up with Schroeder.
I sort of played with all of your characters and thought, okay, if they were named different, you know, I mean, when you hear a friend who's having a baby and they choose a name and you think it kind of doesn't go, and then when you get to know that child, it's like, oh, of course, that's, you know, so they kind of grow into your names.
That's
but
right.
I think with characters, it often starts the other way. So thank you. I appreciate that. I'm fascinated by the fact that Esther started as a series of stories, and your character, Jen, throughout Women in Bed is handled through stories. And then Amity Schroeder is a novel. Was there ever the beginning of a short story there, or did you?
No, I'm a horrible short story writer. I keep trying, but can't really make much progress. No, it was always going to be a novel, yeah.
So in terms of writing stories, how do you show a character's progression in their identity through a series of stories that also, I believe, have to stand on their own? I mean, I think, or if you think that your stories have to stand on your own. I know, Jessica, you've published them, some of them individually, so they don't have the context of the stories that come before or after. And Miriam, I'm not sure, did you publish Esther stories?
I have published some, yes.
So how difficult is that to deal with a character's change in identity or development over a very short number of pages?
Well, I mean, I do adore the short story form, so and I've been writing for many years. So actually the stories within this collection probably span more than a decade in terms of even my own writing them of them, maybe even a few decades. I think writers are obsessive type people often, and I certainly kept returning probably to, you know, this issue of woman protagonists struggling with different aspects of emotional, I guess I want to say battles. I mean, from within the context, again, of relationships. So, you know, in this collection, I mean, I have, you know, the woman is alone or she's separated from or breaking up with a boyfriend. Other stories deal with divorce. Another story deals with breakdown, but I guess again, I always come back to sort of some emotional problem, struggle. So in terms of the progression, I think in this case, it was just, maybe it was my own self growing up a little bit or having my own experiences that I could bring more to each story and was more interested in other aspects of some of these emotional issues as I wrote different stories. I think that's probably the best I can come up with at the moment.
And Miriam, why did you decide to turn being Esther into a novel rather than a linked collection?
Again, I'm much more comfortable in the short story form, and I've written many short stories. And one of them was one of the Esther stories, and it was the first story, and it was really triggered by a memory that I'd had from when I was growing up about two older women who lived in Miami Beach in a condominium, and I was maybe in college at the time and visiting, and I remember overhearing the woman I was staying with calling a friend, and I learned that they called each other every morning to make sure that they'd each made it through the night. And
wow.
So I had this story about Esther where every morning she wakes up at, you know, at 8:30 a.m. sharp, she calls Lorraine or Lorraine calls her. And that was the first story. And then I wrote another story about this woman because I really liked her. And there was a third story, and all of a sudden the book evolved because I wanted to know more about her. And then it became almost more not formulaic, but I had to start feeling like I had to fill in gaps to make it more, it's not a plot-driven book. The only thing, you know, if there's even any suspense, is it is Esther going to end up in assisted living? So it's not very plot-driven. It's very much a character study. But I ended up just, it was more a matter of filling in the blanks and wanting to know more about her.
Okay. And Amity, why did you choose a letter to tell Eric's story? Why that form?
Well, When I started to hear Eric's voice, I really did feel that I was, as some writers say, kind of channeling, that there was a voice that kind of I started to hear, and he was talking to someone. This is my first novel in first person, and I've always wondered about first person. Of course, the convention is that the first person is just talking to somebody. You know, who's the first person talking to? I don't know, you, I guess. But for me, that didn't make sense. I didn't understand who. I would like him to have an addressee, you know, basically. So she's his addressee. And when I was a kid, I wrote a lot of sort of tortured, like, love letters that I didn't send to boys that didn't even know who I was. And I got my practice there. But they sort of unrequited, or the letter that never gets sent, you know, I just thought was a really cool form to work with. And towards the end of the book, he kind of realizes that Laura will probably never read it. So it just helped focus me, yeah.
So if we have questions from the audience, just come on down to the mics, and I'm sure people would love to. I can't see a thing out there, I'm sorry. Yeah. Do we have anybody walking? Surely someone has a question. Great, thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the presentations. One thing that I'm curious about in writing for the modern age, we have a society now that communicates via made-up identities, via pictures and names and descriptions that are made up out of whole cloth. When writing a complex story trying to define somebody's identity, how do you take into account the fact that people make up their own identities when they communicate with each other, especially when they communicate with vast numbers of other people?
That's a great question.
That's a really great question.
Yeah, we'll get back to us, you know, like an hour. I'll come back and answer that question. No, I think that's true. I think it's amazing. It blows my mind how much this issue of identity and who you are happens on any internet interaction and constructing yourself on Facebook or all of these issues. It's fascinating. I find it a little bit depressing, you know. I think for that reason I feel a little estranged from it. I think, oh, isn't this a problem that we can't have a sort of, I mean, my attempt in a relationship would be to get, I guess, closer to someone who someone really is when I know him or her. And I feel like that, the technology is almost an impediment to that objective.
I'm thinking more along the lines of writing and using it to reveal aspects of a character. Like, why does somebody choose to build this Frankenstein's monster within the cybernetic world, and then what aspects of their own personality are being reflected in that?
Sounds like you're ready to write a book about it.
Yeah. Be up here next year and answer your question. Do you have anything to add, Mary or Jessica?
You know, I guess I want to say that the whole thing about identity, again, maybe my obsession is just the struggle to tell the truth. I think, you know, in both cases, your books, you've got this, the lie, and, you know, you're trying to figure out what the truth is. And I think that my characters are always struggling to find some point of honesty, and it seems like the internet and all of that is maybe amplifying, I think, maybe the same issues. It's just amplified, and maybe, you know, we're getting savvier about it too. I mean, I know I used to get pulled in with certain stuff, and now I know, oh, wait a minute, don't just believe that because it's there, you know, on Facebook or something. So, you know, I think as a social group, we're becoming more savvy about it. But I think it still goes back to similar issues of humanity and, you know, who are we and what's the truth and how can you tell it's the truth and or what's a lie. That's how I see it.
We have a question over here.
Yes. My question has to do with how do you learn and hone your skills of observation for detail that you want to put in your stories? How much of that is like something you're doing every minute of the day or as an act of homework to get ready for your story versus, you know, if I'm actually looking at tech, you know, I'm looking at something here and you're maybe going to use that versus it's all in my imagination for this character. I'm not asking very articulately, but...
No, I think I get it, and I thought something similar, actually, when, Miriam, you read the part about the sugar bowl, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure I would have dreamt up a sugar bowl, but of course, the minute you brought it up, I thought, you know, I pictured the sugar bowl on my grandmother's table or something. Yeah.
Do you want to take that one? I mean, I think we're always aware and looking around, and sometimes there may be a gap, or I'll read something and I'll say, oh yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it, or you maybe don't know, or you've written the story, and then you go back and you're refining, and you say, no, maybe it should be a sugar bowl, and Esther wouldn't have a vodka bottle on her table, you know? I mean, there's certain, you know, parameters that, I mean, you already understand your character enough, and I don't have doilies and, you know, ruffled placemats, but I thought that a character like Esther would, and I don't know where those details come from, and sometimes also in terms of this book, I read a lot of diaries of particularly Mae Sarton, who wrote books of in her later decades, and each book spanned a decade. And you know, I learned a lot about what it was like to be, you know, to be older, in your 70s, in your 80s, and so I'm starting to push the envelope myself, but so it's through a combination of things, although I don't know that you get details there, but feelings of what does it feel like, too. So it comes from everywhere. It's like in the air, you know.
Well, I was just going to say, in my last story, Heart, it's really, it just takes place in a hotel room in Paris, and Jen is with her lover, and it's not a very nice hotel room, and she's really freaking out about that. And it seems that the few objects that are in the room, you know, sort of the lumpy bed, and there's one armoire, and the bathroom's not working. Those all become reflections of how she's feeling emotionally. So I felt very conscious about using specific details in that regard to play off the character's inner life. And how she was feeling at that moment within the relationship.
I think that that writers are, you can't trust a writer. A writer is always at work and always trying to take things. Writers are like crows who see a shiny little thing and put it in their nest, you know, and I'll steal from anybody. I mean, there's so many influences in the book. People might cite, you know, one news story over it, but there's so many other things that I've stolen. My mother's own immigrant story is really this story. I steal from my own kid, so I have a charming 7-year-old boy who says a lot of very cute things. So how do you think I wrote the character Meadow, right? I just grabbed things that my son said and put them in her mouth. So, sometimes people will cite a line like, oh, I love this line that you wrote, and it's something Meadow says, and it's just been totally plagiarized from my own son. And all the best lines in the book. And so I'm good at writing those down. Like, what's the difference between me and someone else who's got a cute kid who says cute things? Like, I write it down and I look for the right place to, you know. And so everything is at the service of the writing. And it's a cool way to live. I mean, it's a weird way to live. It makes things, everything has utility. And you're always creating a sort of form out of your daily experience.
Great. Was there a question over here?
Yeah. So I'm wondering, obviously these are, all of your characters are created in your own mind, so there's a lot of you in them. And I'm wondering how much of the process of kind of creating these people is really just putting your own thoughts in their head, and how much of it is really a fight to kind of fight against who you are and your thoughts. You say, I am this person, so I'm just going to put me inside of them, versus this isn't me, and I have to kind of build the opposite of myself in order to kind of create that contrast. I mean, I imagine there might be a risk of all your characters sounding like the same person, because you're one person yourself.
Great question.
Well, in my case, I'm writing from the point of view of a man, and, you know, a German man. So to me, it really helps to have the character be apart from me in some way, gender, ethnicity, something that is not me, so that I don't fall into the trap, what I think feels like a trap to me, of just writing fictionalized autobiography. I've actually never really been interested in that. However, like, my writing is also so deeply personal, too. So like I said, I'm telling my mother's immigrant story through this guy who, like, kidnaps his daughter. But it's really true. So I think there's almost a always a parallel for me. They're invented situations so that I can kind of push them away to arm's length so that I can invent them rather than just be telling my own story. Yeah.
I guess that I want to say that I'm very interested in going very deeply in a personal way with a character. So I want to feel that I can identify on some level with the emotional drama that's going on within that character, but I definitely have to get to a point of feeling completely separate so that character has, you know, is not me. I mean, that it just, I have to get to that point so that I feel free and liberated, and then I can really maybe infuse or create other problems or conflicts that I'm interested in watching, getting, you know, sort of as a play, just watching it play out in a sense, just because I'm interested in emotional conflicts in general. So,
yeah, I was just thinking that memoir is it would be the form or the container for writing more about yourself. And I think this question touches on what we talked about earlier, like how do you know what objects to put in? There are things that we see or things that we make up, but they're not necessarily, as I said, you know, I don't have the doy, you know, the ruffled placemats. So I think we do, I think you talked about needing to keep your character at a distance. Mm-hmm. I think it would get all muddied if it becomes you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Do we have another question? Okay. If we, I have a last question, then I'll just take them. So it's National Reading Group Month, and that's part of the reason that the Women's National Book Association put this panel together. So just briefly, if my book club was sitting in my living room after a couple glasses of wine, could you please tell us sort of what the burning discussion would be if we were discussing each of your books? And you can be as irreverent as you like or as serious as you like.
Jessica, you start.
Oh my God.
Give me a minute.
Remember, I want to know.
I would want you all to get into a bed and put your PJs on or no. Well, I would hope it would be a good excuse to talk about possibly those points in relationships that didn't work out, loneliness, despair, grief, loss, the feeling of rejection, the pain of a lost love or love that you didn't achieve or capture or find, and that you could discuss those feelings using the excuse of these stories so that you don't have to feel that you're revealing your whole own personal life. That, I suppose, might be my hope.
You've been in our book club, obviously. Either of you?
Miriam?
I'm still thinking.
Well, go ahead. I think that there's a couple of issues that my book raises, and one is aging and how we deal with aging parents. And so I think that would obviously be something that would trigger some discussion. And also then that gets to the relationship of a mother-daughter. There's mm-hmm. a strong mother-daughter relationship element to the story, and it seems to, for the book groups I've talked with, seems to be a real trigger point.
Yes. Well, I've sat with book clubs discussing Schroeder, and it gets pretty heated, actually, mm-hmm. the discussion. I think it sort of brings up, there's a lot of debate about whether or not he's kind of a monstrous person, or whether he's actually just a lot like you or me. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's probably somewhere in between. I love how people have to question what have I done as a parent, or what do I feel as a child looking at my parent about how they parented me, and how do you parent if you're not perfect? So I think there's some healthy debate around all of this.
Thank you. Well, Miriam Carmel, Jessica Keener, and Amity Gage, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne.
Our authors will all be out at the table outside of this auditorium signing books, and there are books for sale there from Trident Bookshop if you want to get a copy. Thank you very much, everybody.